The problem is, you do see a lot of antisocial people succeed. Loneliness is as big a risk factor for ill health and death.
You know, we live inside our heads.
You go cold turkey, you go into withdrawal.
There is a lot of value in the stuff that we struggle with.
Better Thinking, conversations with experts exploring all things psychology.
Welcome back to Better Thinking. My name is Nesh Nikolic, and my guest today is Associate Professor Lucette Sistique, a neuropsychologist researcher whose interests lie in modeling neurocognitive and brain changes based on chronic infectious conditions such as HIV infection and COVID-19. Lucette completed her neuropsychology undergraduate and graduate degrees in France and the UK. Her neuropsychology PhD in Australia, and her neuropsychology and neuroimaging postdocs in the US and Australia. Currently, Lucette is a senior lecturer at UNSW School of Psychology, and she also leads and co-leads neuro-HIV trials nationally and internationally. In addition, Lucette is chair of the NeuroCOVID International Neuropsychological Society Special Interest Group. I'm pleased to be able to share with you today my conversation with Lucette, looking at the need for understanding post-viral syndromes and how doing so would help the better, longer-term outcomes for individuals and the community as a whole. There's a bit of a cultural shift that needs to occur, and hence why I think this conversation is so important. Enjoy. Lucette, a big thank you for coming onto the show today. I'm really excited about talking about your space around mild cognitive deficits, or at least being able to identify them, potentially detect them early, and how they can be a sign of, you know, some quite serious infectious diseases like HIV and COVID. I think this is not an area that gets too much attention, yet I think the implications can be quite significant and enormous. So real appreciation for you coming onto the show today.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
I'm actually excited to start off with how you got into this space. This is quite a niche space. So maybe you could talk me through that to start
off.
Yeah,
that's a very good question. Well, as my accent probably, you know, betrays, I'm not Australian born. I was born in France, and I got interested into neuropsychology and neuroscience as part of my psychology research. And then eventually I did some research in Alzheimer's disease. And I have to say that at the time I was quite young, I was in my early 20s. At the time, working in Alzheimer's disease for a young person, a young neuropsychologist, was a little bit daunting. There was, you know, no hope for treatment. I mean, there was a treatment, but it was not working. So it was quite challenging. And I have to say, so what's good is that there's now hope. There's new treatment coming on the way. So that's great. But that's like, that's going to betray my age. It's going to be like 25 years ago. Anyway, so I was really interested in brain science, in neuropsychology, and the clinical aspect. And I was interested in aging. But at the same time, being myself coming from a minority and being interested in sort of other way of thinking about the brain, I end up being interested in the effect of HIV on the brain. And I met a neuropsychologist at the time in Paris who was working with Jacques Gano, actually, I think his name was. I forgot her name, Sandra. That's terrible that I forgot her name. It will come back. Anyway, so she introduced me to the work, and seeing some patient, Camille Bissette in Paris. And I got interested right away because of the patient population. And at the time as well, I was in connection with an activist from ACT UP, actually, in Paris, who was worried about, you know, this aspect of health in people with HIV. People were He was more concerned about the issue of mental health, but when we met the neurologist Gano and Kamla Bissette, he was more interested in a neurological aspect, and he's actually quite well known for some of the research in some changes due to the white matter change in the brain in HIV. Anyway, so meeting all those people, I felt that it was, you know, the right connection for me to bring my expertise in brain science and the idea of working in a population that was a minority. I was interested in that, a younger population, and yet to be able to make some changes, because it was at the time where the new treatment were arriving. So there was hope that when people could be detected early, they could get treated and they could get better quite rapidly. And it was actually quite amazing to see people, really presenting with dementia and coming out from it. It was actually quite a unique experience as a young neuropsychologist to experience that. And so after that, I decided that I would come to Australia, do my PhD, because my partner is Australian. So I thought, we wanted to leave Paris at the time, and we wanted to, we had lived in Paris for quite a long time. So we wanted to have our life somewhere else. And so I did my PhD with Professor Brew at St. Vincent's Hospital, and Professor Paul Maruff, who was a neuropsychologist who had worked in HIV as well at the time. And that's how I got into that, and never looked back. So it's a funny story, because I didn't know anyone in I didn't know anyone coming from Paris. I didn't know anyone in Australia, so I contacted Professor David Cooper, who was the head of the Kirby Institute, where I'm based now. And he said, "Oh, I'm not working on the neurology. You need to contact Professor Brosbrough." And so I contacted Professor Brosbrough, and he was interested right away. And that was the beginning of an amazing collaboration.
It's amazing. And welcome to Oz. I hope you've enjoyed
Well, I've been
it.
Here Clearly since 2001, so I'm partly Australian for sure.
You're Aussie as it gets. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's it. I'm definitely partly Aussie, because when I go back to France, I feel that I'm a bit Aussie for sure.
And tell me about this space around mild cognitive deficits. I imagine this is such a difficult area to work in that so many people would report some type of mild cognitive deficit.
Yeah.
The importance of early
yeah.
detection is incredible, you know, in terms of, you know, treatment, and I'm sure that in terms of outcomes,
exactly.
You know, everything is always about early intervention.
Yeah.
So maybe you can just talk me through a little bit about what do mild cognitive deficits look like, at least in your world, and what you're looking for, and whether it's anything different with HIV or COVID or other conditions as well.
Yeah. Well, if you don't mind, I'll just go back to that story, leaving France. You know, I was working in an INSERM unit who was specialized in brain aging, and I was also working as a neuropsychologist in a Parisian hospital in the south of Paris, in the 14th arrondissement. And in that in these two positions, I met a lady that has marked me forever, this story, because I was quite young, you know, I was again in my early 20s, and so I had her as a control participant in one of my research at the time. And she came as she was extremely anxious, and she did all the tests, and she said to me, "Do you think I've got dementia? Because my mother had it, and I really want to know ahead of time." And so I remember looking at the tests at the time, you know, there was nothing really that was, you know, suggestive yet of anything significant. Some maybe subtle change in her behavior, maybe. But then, 2 or 3 years later, when I was working in the hospital, she came as a patient, and she was already extremely, you know, deteriorated. And she said to me, she recognized me, and she said, "Why you didn't tell me?" And I that has stuck with me, that story that was stuck with me. So I guess maybe there's sometime in the way of me trying to not ignore, you know, early signs, there's maybe that story that's there as well. Because he was very emotionally you know, something strong when you leave when you're quite young, and that I remember forever. And she was already so deteriorated, and she still remembered me. And so I guess when I entered HIV, the difference was that we could detect things and we could treat people. When I say we, so I'm a neuropsychiatrist, I don't prescribe the medication, but we work in concert. So we detect the level of deficits and, you know, the pattern of deficits. And then the neurologist, with all their other examination, put a diagnosis. But the idea is we need to detect early, because then we knew that when people have had HIV for a long time, for example, and if they had starting to have cognitive impairment, the longer they've had, you know, those deficits without treatment, and the least reversible it would be. And we have, I worked while working both broads in Vincent's Hospital during my PhD. I did some research on people like that who had dementia. And they've with the treatment, things stabilized to a certain extent, but the one who had been off treatment and the most demented for a long time, I never fully recovered as well. Wow. So that's why I think the preventative aspect for me and the detection of early deficits is really important. And then then working with patient and the community, and I'm still doing that today, they are a part of the community who's really advocating for early detection and trying to find solution as early as possible. There is another part of the community who's really scared about the topic, and maybe is a bit less willing to confront things frontally. But so I work with one particular community activist in the US, Jules Levine. He's been doing that for many years, and he's the head of NATAP, which is the National AIDS Treatment Advocacy Program, I think, in the US. And so with him, I guess, and other colleagues, we've done that international group, and that's what we're pushing. We're pushing for early detection, early management, and we've been pushing that for many years. And it's interesting, because while we've been pushing for that, the Alzheimer's field and the overall dementia has caught up, and they're really promoting this now. Why? It's because in the last 20 years of neuroscientific research, one of the main finding is that anything that has to do with progressive neurodegenerative diseases, you know, in old age, we know that they do start way earlier in life, and 20, sometimes even 30 years before the actual sign appear. And so with this in mind, even if the context in HIV and COVID is a bit different, with this in mind, the field of neuropsychology and neuroscience has been more and more able to detect things early and the earliest. And so there's an ethical question then. At what time do you actually, probably tell the patient, you are at risk of cognitive impairment, or there's, you have some mild deficits? Or most often, actually, people do realize that they have some deficit, but some not all people do. It depends on many factors. But I guess the reticence, is that an English word or a French word, this one? The difficulty of the medical community, and I was talking with a young doctor about that the other day, to diagnose early and early as possible is when there's no treatment, they feel like it's not the appropriate things to do. And they're correct, only to a certain extent. So when the research that has been done now in dementia that has actually surpassed us in HIV, we were ahead, and I think we're a bit behind now. But the research that shows that when you detect people, patient early, first, most of them want to know, maybe not everybody, but most people want to know, so that they can manage the situation as best as possible. And a management is not only a medication, it's a cross-disciplinary approach, where like a bit like a geriatric approach, where depending on the person's difficulty, there's going to be, some psychological helps, some rehabilitation help of different kind, some social help, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not going to cure things, but it's going to cushion and support, you know, people's life and quality of life. And also it's going to help the carers and the family, the loved one around, to understand what's going on as well. So there's going to be this kind of adaptation to, or what am I able to do? Like in the case of any mild disability, really, it's my life is not over. It's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is adapting to your new level of functioning. And I think it's not something that infectious disease physicians have been trained for. Mm. They've been trying to treat a disease that's acute, like an acute infection. And like the way they responded during the pandemic, the COVID pandemic, it was fantastic. But that framework does not work for chronic neurological diseases. For chronic neurological diseases, we need an early approach, as detection as early as possible. If there's treatment down the line, that's great as well. Like hopefully there's going to be for Alzheimer's soon. But those treatment in Alzheimer's, more and more, there's the sort of already, you know, we can already see that they have to be initiated early to, if not, you know, stop, at least delay, you know, the neurodegeneration. Everybody knows that after a certain level of neurodegeneration, there is no coming back, unfortunately. So in HIV and COVID and all the infectious diseases, we're not talking about neurodegeneration. It's just different. It's probably going to be more like neuroinflammation. But again, the level of deficit that we detect is mild. It's what I mean by that is that people still have the capacity to think about complex things. Their reasoning is intact. The capacity to make decision is still okay. And a lot of the hard learned, you know, capacities are still there. But anything that has to be about multitasking, things that will involve, you know, a high level of cognitive effort, learning new information that's quite complex, then that's going to be challenging, more or less challenging. And so the doctors, sometimes the medical doctors, you know, when they see patient like that, they're like, oh, you know, you can still do this, all the basics in your everyday life. So they think they're fine. But there is no reason to intervene at this level because the person is still functioning fairly well. Mm-hmm. But what we see, and we've seen it during COVID, is that when people are high functioning and they drop, you know, by maybe half a standard deviation on some of the tests we do, actually they can't actually complete with efficiency their level of activity. And for some of them, it's more than that, but that's where it starts. And that can be extremely distressing for some people. It depends on the, you know, basic functioning, the baseline functioning that people had. But if someone, let's just say, I guess one of the best example is people who fly planes, you know, the pilots. Those people get tested all the time. Mm. Okay, so if they develop this level of mild deficit, they wouldn't be able to fly. You know, that would be detected on the test that they done. So that's the level of functioning we're talking about. It's really high complex tasks that are going to be affected. With long COVID, there's also the and to some extent HIV, there's also the issue of the fatigue. So that's something else, and it's mental fatigue. So it's not only whether you're able to do a task as fast as you can do it, but once you've done it, once you've put an effort into it, then you're extremely fatigued once you've finished, and even worse the day after. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. that's another symptom. But so
how predictive are these markers for dementia in terms of being able to detect a change and then be confident in that it is associated with, you know, a dementia? I imagine it's probably a bit different with HIV. There's probably a simpler, you know, pathology that test that can go out and say yes or no or whatever it might be, or maybe with COVID as well. And please correct me if I'm wrong here as well. Is there a, you know, are there strong markers for this now that have been developed, rather than, you know, the haziness about saying, oh, I'm not quite sure, I do get a bit forgetful or sometimes disorientated or whatever it might be. We can all certainly see it when it's in its severe chronic phase. But there's, as you say, the importance of finding it early.
Yeah. So maybe what I didn't clarify is that what we worried a little bit in HIV at the moment and in other area or similar area would be COVID as well, is that there's a part of the population who, when they get HIV or they've lived with HIV for a long time, same with COVID, people are also aging at the same time. And it's actually very difficult to distinguish normal aging from abnormal aging in people with chronic conditions. Mm-hmm. It's actually much harder than what has just been recently developed for Alzheimer's disease, I guess. So with Alzheimer's disease, there's some blood tests that are coming up to detect amyloid in the blood and in the brain. But so how can I explain that? I think so. It's important to distinguish. That's what's difficult in our field, is that the disease, what's expressed as the disease, depending on people's age, is going to be different. So once we have someone who's lived with HIV for, let's say, 40 years and start to reach the 70s, we're not talking about the same thing as developing, a bit of mild cognitive impairment when you're in your 30s with the same condition.
Sure.
Things are quite different. And so I think what we're trying in our field there with that group that I've put together, what we're trying to bring is some of the knowledge from the psychology of aging and also the neuropsychology of aging and the dementia field into the knowledge of how to deal with early cognitive impairment in people who are aging with HIV or with long COVID, for example. So that's what we're trying to do. But when we can use some of that knowledge for people who are younger, but the truth is that it's not the same, right?
Sure.
So what were you? What the original question that you've asked? Sorry,
question was about how predictive the markers are.
So it depends which marker you are talking about. But so the neuropsychology field found, it's at least 30 years ago, that there was some studies showing that new learning of information was predictive of cognitive decline in old age. So that has been done, in the 90s, and that for some reason, those findings have always been, under-recognized to some extent, because I think the issue with neuropsychological tests is that they are very sensitive actually to all kinds of things. They're not only sensitive to the actual deficits that you're interested in, they're going to be sensitive to, well, age first, your level of education. A woman usually have better memory than men, especially in older age. There's some cultural factors that will impact the test results. So they have to be handled quite carefully, those tests. And so while those findings are interesting, they do not have the sort of a solid aspect of a biological marker, you've got a certain level of amyloid, then this means, although, even with amyloid, actually, you can have a certain level of amyloid and function fairly well. So it's not always black and white there either, but it's even more complex with neuropsychological aspect. So what's interesting about neuropsychological aspect is that it does reflect people's current cognitive functioning, though. It's part of the puzzle. So because some people today would want to, those biological markers to, basically be at the forefront and everything else come next. But the truth is that when it's about the brain, it's always more complex.
Yeah.
So you need
pattern recognition.
You need to know if people have a certain level of biomarker that's abnormal. But the truth is that you need also to examine the cognitive functioning to see if if there's some level of change as well. So it kind of goes together. So how predictive are the markers? Well, let's just say there are some genetic markers for cognitive decline, and there are some, as I said, neuropsychological markers, And when they do all come together, they are quite predictive, actually. unfortunately for people who develop the disease, but they are quite predictive, and that's why the pharmaceutical company that are developing tests now for sorry, that are developing medication for dementia actually are targeting people earlier and earlier, because they know that those tests are actually quite predictive.
And what are you seeing as being the most prevalent signs when you're doing this research? Obviously, you mentioned that the early studies looked at, difficulties with new learning are quite predictive. Where is the science at the moment? What sort of markers do you look for?
So you mean in terms of neuropsychological changes? Well, so as I said, there are some criteria that have been put out there to look at what's called subjective cognitive decline. So it involves not only objective performance on some cognitive test, but it involves also how people themselves describe their cognitive difficulties as well. And so there's even some evidence that we can use what's called a practice effect as an outcome to predict if people are going to have some sort of to use as a prediction of how much they're going to be able to learn in the future. But I'm just we're not in a situation where there's a one test that answers all the questions. That's what I'm trying to say. What I'm trying to say is that it's really a cross-disciplinary effort. It's the same with neuroimaging. So neuroimaging as well come into the foray there. So there are some changes in the brain that we know that are going to be predictive of some neurodegenerative changes. But the truth is that it's really when all of that is brought together that a clearer picture emerge.
And is there obviously COVID was a huge worldwide phenomenon experience. Was there a body of work that came out of this? Because we certainly heard a lot of people, and I certainly felt it when I became unwell on the physical front. I was astonished about how my breathing was affected. I would walk probably less than 100 meters and I'd be out of breath, and I can't recall any illness that knocks me about that way. I've certainly heard of a lot of people talking about it, long COVID, and how, people feel foggy in the brain and all sorts of things. Has there been substantial research in that space being, maybe an area that so much data has been collected or still working
Yeah,
through
so yeah,
the
so
masses, I'm assuming?
so it's really a hot topic. So there's a huge amount of research. It's massive. Every time I look at this research, about neurological changes and cognitive changes, brain changes in COVID, there's new papers all the time. It's enormous. Most of it is not from Australia. Most of it comes from, overseas, but still, we have a place in Australia. We I guess we're catching up. We've done some work, here at St. Vincent's and at the Kirby, but basically, so I was trying to get at earlier. I'm not sure if I was really clear. So I think COVID, sorry, the COVID epidemic was a revelator. So it was a revelator in the sense that people have always sort of thought of infectious disease as an acute condition. In the case of COVID, for example, that was respiratory. But I think it put the emphasis on what's called post-viral syndrome and also post-infective syndrome. Actually, there's a whole era of study on this that has been still sometimes still a bit ignored nowadays, that framework. And that framework is very important. It's been recognized for quite a long time. And it actually fits really, really well the field of long COVID. So there we know that after a certain viral infection, we know that people can develop a post-viral syndrome. So it's The difference with the virus is that some viruses are directly neurotropic or neurotoxic as well. So they're going to really have a deleterious neurological effect, and it's very obvious. But for a lot of other viruses and viruses that present as respiratory viruses, like COVID, the changes that are created cognitively post-viral are actually mild cognitive changes. People do not get dementia. So that's where it kind of links back with what I was trying to say earlier, is that, and we know that most people who develop long COVID are actually between 20 and 50 years of age. And so so we're not talking about an older age situation, although there's some research there as well. But so what I'm trying to say is that all this knowledge that we have about detecting cognitive deficit early applies to post-viral syndromes, because we know how to detect them best, and we know we can use the framework of post-infective fatigue research to actually try to understand how much the fatigue contribute to the issue, how much mental health contribute to the issue, or do not, etc., etc. And so I think the COVID and the story of long COVID has been a big revelator in the sense that, oh, actually, you know, this field should not be a niche area. It's actually, you know, a major health issue, as much as cardiovascular disease or, I don't know, renal or cancer. Because when you look at the impact of long COVID in terms of, you know, economic impact, some people put it as high as cardiovascular disease, for example. Maybe not as much, but I mean, not as high as in the long term, but in the last few years of the pandemic, that had have a massive impact. And so some countries have responded better than others. And the UK, because I'm doing some research on this at the moment, the UK is responding absolutely amazingly. Despite all the what we can hear about the UK in terms of their health care over there, not only they've responded amazingly in terms of the NHS, in terms of the way they've created some clinics all over the country for long COVID, but they've also reacted really well in terms of their research response. And they've created, you know, very large cohort to understand what is long COVID, how often it happens, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We're not yet there in Australia. We've done some work, but we're not yet there. But I think one of the major revelation of this situation is that what has been called brain fog and long COVID, a major component of it is cognitive changes. And they are those small cognitive changes that are very difficult to detect. Okay, because they're difficult to detect in the sense that people, again, people are if they go and see the doctors, you know, they don't present as demented, you know, they don't present as very impaired, and they're going to complain of mind changes that are not very that do not seem like dramatically, you know, impacting on their life, but they do describe those changes, and they can't go to work normally. They can't concentrate as much. You know, I've got a colleague. You know, their difficulty was not that they couldn't go to work. No, their difficulty was they couldn't write their presentation as fast as usual. You know, and there was this kind of, you know, added fatigue and difficulty in doing it. So we're talking really about subtle changes sometimes, but we. What I want to, I guess, the message to medical doctors here is that myself, I've done, you know, 30 years of neuropsychology. When I see this patient, you know, and I talk to them face to face like this, I cannot detect anything like that. I have to do some tests to be able to detect. And even sometimes the tests themselves, depending on how high functioning are the people, it's actually very difficult to detect the changes as well. We have to put them in situations that are extremely demanding for it to show. Because I think sometimes the cognitive assessment gives people a kind of support situation, and so they're still able to perform quite well. So I'm trying at the moment to remove that, to create some new test paradigm where I remove that support, and people have to fend for themselves like they would be in the real world. Anyway, so I think that is changing things, hopefully, because there's a lot of research being done. And the other aspect is there's a lot of biomarker research being done in terms of neuroimaging, biological marker, etc. And we do find some abnormalities. So there's also the idea that, well, it's actually not in people's head. You know, there's really something going on, you know, because the issue with those patients is that when they go and see their doctors, they do get the feedback that it's all in their head and it's a psychological issue. Not, you know, and we know that it's not exactly correct, or at least we know that some of the self-perception of cognitive change is also affected as well in some patient, right? Anyway, so to answer to your question, yes, there is a huge amount of research of long COVID. It's massive. There are some very, very large studies being conducted in the US. And those studies have already created, you know, some research trial, you know, how to intervene and respond, both of them, you know, like cognitive intervention and those kind of things, but also medication. So it's actually a massive area of research. It's enormous at the moment. Yeah.
It's fascinating because it poses that question of these post-viral syndromes, the opportunity to go out and support people. And you mentioned that the UK is responding really well to long COVID against a medical system or a system that is going to struggle to detect it. And that might be because, not that the opportunity isn't highly valuable, but in terms of it is so mild that it is often misinterpreted as it's not very significant. You know, it might be just, you know, you're having an off day. We all feel a bit foggy at times. So all of this goes under the radar against, you know, sending someone for a test. And I think that's probably a great challenge for, I think, what GPs do. They're absolutely amazing and extraordinary people and such incredible professionals. At the same time, they've always got those very challenging decisions to make about when do I go and send a patient to have an examination, a test, you know, how much pressure is already in the system for these types of tests, how many people are there out there doing it versus saying, you know, my experience tells me that most of these things are, you know, nothing, air quotes, so to speak.
So I guess there's two, three things that I should have said. So first is that the majority of people who get COVID recover. That's a fact, you know. I mean, it's so the people who actually develop long COVID is a minority. It's actually a true minority, you know. It's not the majority, but it's big enough because so many people have had COVID, so it's big enough that it will put pressure on the health system. The second thing is that the GP actually do recognize those patients, because the one that I know, I mean, I talk to, they do sit, and what they want help. What they want is they want help on how to manage those patients. That's what they want. And the third thing that I wanted to say is beside the help that the GP want, there's also existing treatment that are available. So they're not medical treatment, but they're, you know, different strategy that have been developed for chronic fatigue syndrome, for example, including psychological sort of intervention of different kind that do exist that we actually work and help people. And I should say also, that's the one that I wanted to say, is that even including among people who will develop long COVID across a few months, the majority as well recover. So in other words, what's needed is a support across the board when people are feeling unwell, because the majority do recover as well spontaneously.
And can you say a little bit about what the UK is doing? You mentioned that they've responded well, that they've opened up particular clinics to support not only patients, but I assume support GPs. Looking for assistance and support as to how to help their patients.
Yeah. So as part of my current position here at the Kirby Institute, I'm employed as by the APRISE, the APRISE consortium. So, and I will have to go like this. I just have to tap APRISE because I don't want to say something wrong. So the APRISE It's just this acronym that's like, yeah, the Australian Partnership for Preparedness Research on Infectious Disease Emergencies, which is at the Doherty Institute in Melbourne. So this consortium has also a long COVID initiative, which I'm one of the leader besides Professor Lena Sensi and Professor Andrew Lloyd. And our job is to conduct a new prospective study about better understanding long COVID, but also better understand what Australia has done as an early response. And so doing that job, I went to check what other country had done. So I went to check what UK had done, Canada and the US. And the UK had the best responses, the sense that they developed early services for long COVID. And they've listed all of that on, you know, NHS. They've got a list of clinics all over the country. And they've also put, educational tools for both the community and the doctors on how to manage long COVID. And they've also, beside the WHO created a definition of long COVID, the US CDC, the UK did as well, so they've also developed their own, which creates some problem actually because everybody's using a bit different things. But you know they've done that too. And then the next step that they've done, they've given money quite early on to determine the health consequence of COVID, and doing that, then they transform more and more into what is long COVID, what is the biology of long COVID, how much long COVID do we have really, the different types of long COVID. Some people is more cardiac, some people is more brain, some people is more respiratory, etc. And so they've put some $50 million of dollars into funding about 19 major cohorts across the UK. And so, and they've done them in a timely fashion. So they've started to do it early in 2020 onwards. So they have data on the early people who were a victim of the, you know, Alpha and Delta variant, because it is correct that the Omicron variant are less severe. But and then there's been the vaccinations as well. So they've kind of had a well-rounded response, yeah. And they've also done a lot of effort to also follow sort of the WHO guideline in the sense of sharing data and tracking the data nationally to national coordinated response to inform WHO about, you know, what they find. So that's been pretty amazing. So we're trying to follow in their track here with the APRISE by mapping, you know, everything that has happened early in the pandemic. And we have our own prospective cohort where we're going to try to better understand understand what long COVID is. I think where we are ahead compared to other countries that we work with, specialists of post-viral syndrome that have been working on this for like, 40 years. My boss, my current boss, Professor Andrew Lloyd, and that gives us really, really nice, strict framework to really concentrate on the people who actually have the condition. Okay, because one of the issues with long COVID and all post-viral syndrome is to try to, and same with mild cognitive impairment related to HIV, is to really being able to identify, you know, the people who actually have the condition versus have other problems. And so I remember talking with community, you know, members about this issue, and some of them were a little bit upset because they were saying, well, if the definition is too strict, then you're going to exclude too many people. So it's always a balancing act. But what I was saying is that it's also important to concentrate on the people who have actually the condition, because the people who have something else actually need to be sent to the other part of the care system where they're going to be treated for what actually they have. Mm. So it's not going to be how can I explain? It's not going to be an issue for the patient to be seen for the condition that they actually have versus they don't have. It's actually going to be beneficial for everybody there. But to say that we need to develop a better response to long COVID here in Australia, yes, we do. You know, it's each time I participate to like a occasion like this one, or you know, when I'm doing a talk, is to say that with post-viral syndromes and brain issues, you know, they should not come as an afterthought. It's very likely that cognitive changes will happen with post-virally. They're much less likely when people have had the flu, but it's also possible. So when there is something that is impacting us, COVID, we should think, or the neurology and the brain aspect should be part of the response. It shouldn't come after, if you want.
It's interesting because we've all felt it in one way or another, and we clearly understand that. Obviously, with particular conditions like, you know, cardiac surgeries and the like, you know, there's always these big booklets that go out and say you're likely to experience, you know, changes in emotional regulation, sometimes even, you know, some personality things in terms of the way you tolerate changes in your life. There could be some memory difficulties, et cetera, et cetera. But we don't have these big booklets in other areas of saying, you know, when there's a post-viral infection, what are you likely likely initially, and then maybe subsequently, because as you say, most people still fully recover, but some don't. And knowing that there is another experience to it means that we might be able to get that early intervention, some of it being a lot of things that we can potentially do for ourselves. You know, some of it might be medical related, others might be general health.
Exactly. So if I can jump on what you said, that's exactly what we're trying to do with that group, that international group. So we have a group of scientists who with community activists and doctors, and we've come together from all over the world, and we all worked in HIV for many, many years. And the idea is to develop guidelines for what happened, what should you do. So health literacy for the community, health literacy for the doctors as well. And rather than cognitive deficits or mild cognitive deficits in particular, because I think it's the emphasis, it's not dementia. So that's why sometimes it's underrecognized, but they're also important. So, and they're going to be more frequent in a way. So I have a guideline for the doctors and for the community in using community words, you know, that can talk to a wide range of people. How do you deal with that? What do you do? How do you talk? So, for example, in the US as well, they've done great stuff on their website, you know, NIH and CDC. They have actually guidelines for the patient to say, how do you talk about it to your doctors? Mm-hmm. You know, how do you mention the problem? What kind of information do you bring to your visit to the doctors? So that's what we want to do. We want to do in the context of HIV and HIV and aging, because a lot of people are worried about the question of HIV and aging. And it's a bit specific, this question, because the people who have had HIV now in the 80s are the first generation to get old with HIV. So that's it's a new situation that has never happened before. So sometimes us people from the neuro field, we've seen as a bit fear mongers, or people who bring the bad news, you know, in HIV, because people say, well, HIV is a treated condition, people are not doing so bad, etc. And we want to say, well, there's good knowledge that when people have had chronic condition, whatever they are, unfortunately, they're more at risk for cognitive decline in old age. And with HIV, the issue is, because it's the first generation of people going to get old with HIV, we don't know how it's going to look. We have no idea, because it's new. So we're trying to just be on the alert, and you know, we're not trying to be too pessimistic in the sense that, okay, if you had HIV, then make sure you're going to have dementia. That's not the case. That's not what we find, actually. But we want to also make sure that there's enough knowledge on what people are experiencing, so that we impact on policy and actually the health services that are provided. Because the feedback that we have from quite a few people in the community is that their issue is underrecognized, and when they go to their doctors, they get ignored. Because again, they think there's nothing to do about it, but there are many things. So neuropsychologists are the first it's they're not the only one, but the neuropsychologists are the first person to see, so that and the neurologists as well, they're the first person to see, to initiate this sort of cross-disciplinary intervention. And I'd say, in an ideal world, the best person would be to see a geriatrician. But geriatrician only comes into care when people are fairly old. So it's often 80 plus. Yeah. The issue with HIV is that the aging that people experience with HIV is a little bit premature. So for quite a few of them, I think that geriatric care should start from, you know, at least, I mean, ideally 60 plus, but if it be already 70 plus, that'd be already good.
Mm-hmm. What do you see as being the challenges of a cultural shift? I call it a cultural shift because it seems like it requires people to think differently, you know,
yep.
whether it's GPs or whether it's patients themselves, whether it's, you know, the community, medicine. What do you see is the challenge in starting to think in this way, where, you know, we're really looking early detection and spending that energy to do so, knowing that there's quite a considerate benefit. You know, we often see it early intervention with children, but we don't think in the same way when they're quite mild and they're post viral. We see a similar problem, I think, with post concussive syndrome as well.
Yes.
You know, it's like, well, you know, lots of people have a knock to the head and they're kind of fine, and you'll be right. And maybe it's an Aussie thing, you know, she'll be right.
Because it's all over the world, so no.
Yeah, I imagine it's everywhere, yeah. Right? You know, and hence why humans are so adaptable. But what do you think needs to happen to turn the ship around?
Yeah, I like what you said then, the comparison with mild traumatic brain injuries and concussive syndrome, because it's very similar in the when it's mild, it's very similar to the, you know, the level of severity we're talking about. But yet in some people it has a huge impact on their lives, you know. Anyway, so I think the cultural shift is happening. It's happening through the dementia advocacy group. And so that's why in HIV I'm trying to kind of, you know, bring the two together, because it has happened there. They've done so much work in, it's absolutely mind blowing. The community, the patient themselves, they've got so much work. They do so much work they've done, and they continue to do so much work to destigmatize mild cognitive deficit, destigmatize dementia in general and early dementia. People can still do a lot. There's a lot of resources on the Dementia Australia website, for example, that people can have a look at. Same with the Alzheimer Association. And one of the research that has been done as well is to say, it's about when should we disclose cognitive deficit, you know, as a scared professional. And a lot of the professional association are all for early disclosure based on the patient and community, you know, research and advice and input. But one thing that always come back is that this has to be done in a supportive care system. So disclosure for the sake of disclosure is going to hurt more than do good. Okay. So, so I've got a colleague in the UK, again, it's still the UK, but he's developed this, HIV and aging clinic in called the Orange Clinic. And that's really the feedback that he's got from the community and the doctors. They are keen to look at things early and to engage into an early intervention framework, but it has to be done in a supportive care system where the different pathway to care already exist. So you're in a GP clinic, okay? So you experience mild cognitive deficit because X or Y condition. The GP knows where to send you next. It's not an act of guessing. It's the pathway, the care pathway are already established. And it's an ideal care system where there's a lot of preventative a mechanism that already, or you know, strategy that are there. And but that's what makes a massive difference. And those clinics already exist. Sorry.
Yeah, I was just saying, I can certainly see the value in disclosure, because that in and of itself does begin to change the culture. Because the moment there is disclosure, then as a patient, we all want to know more. We want to know, yep, what are the guidelines, what assistance is there out there, what can I do myself, how can I go out and get further testing.
That's it.
We are all then highly motivated to be part of that conversation.
That's it.
And obviously, I think there's a medical imperative that we do disclose any findings to patients. There is naturally an importance about how disclosure is done, so that people can understand that, you know, we're not saying that this will happen, but we are saying that there are correlations, and, you know, as a starting point, it would be important to do some further testing, and, you know, there is support out there, and here are some of our avenues. It may not be the case, but like a lot of things, we'd be foolish not to go out and examine it. You know, like your leg might not be fractured, but let's go get an x-ray just in case.
And then, so I think the other aspect, so I talked about the importance of the community, you know, in changing, you know, doctors' mind, really. That's what also happened early in HIV, actually. So that's interesting. We're coming back to that. But I think the other aspect is all the research that's currently been done about prevention of cognitive change as we get older. And it does work to a certain extent. So it's not going to be a magic pill again, okay? But there are a lot of healthy behavior that people can have that will help, you know, maintain a good cognitive health as we get older. And so there's this other aspect as well, is that it's a early detection framework and also a prevention framework as well, to some extent. Yeah.
And that's very powerful if it is a cultural conversation that we're having, because I'm assuming a lot of the guidelines would potentially also be beneficial for other cognitive problems or other conditions per se.
Usually, like, they crisscross.
As someone ages, there's many things that overlap. You know, we are an organism that is incredibly complex, and doing one thing doesn't just target your memory or capacity to learn new tasks or any of the other decline markers that we could look at. Yeah, our bodies are affected across the board, so it's very complicated. So,
I think
a great value point there.
And then if people start to develop, you know, clinically significant changes, again, there are a lot of things to do. So, if people are ahead of the, you know, what's potentially happened to them, they're empowered, they're already informed about, you know, what to do. And then they will be typically aware of where to look for, you know, the specialized services and care that are needed for their particular condition, you know. So that includes actually a lot of information from the patient organization. They're absolutely amazing. They do so much work, and they have a lot of good information there, you know, on guiding where people should go, et cetera, et cetera. So again, it's not a magic pill, but it's a way of avoiding, you know, at least in old age, I'm saying, avoiding, you know, going through a very difficult part of your life, isolated and not knowing what's happening to you.
Well, I said, it's absolutely amazing to be able to talk to you and have you as, you know, you know, a force out there that is using, you know, not only research, but, you know, data and human life examples to go out and say, this is really important, because this does not just go out and affect, you know, HIV or you know, COVID, even though these are great examples. You know, all of these post-viral infections, you know, pose a similar things, and we're certainly going to see a lot more of those in the future. Where can people find out more if they wanted to, you know, continue this conversation, whether it's about your work, whether it's about some of these guidelines, whether it's about where the research is going? Where might someone continue?
Well, I think research regarding HIV. So I guess we're trying to develop that new website that's going to be an international website, but it's being built at the moment. But I guess if people want to know more about my research, you can always go on the UNSW University of New South Wales website and they find me there. There's also the APRISE website where there's all the research that we do about long COVID. Mm-hmm. And the other website that I was thinking of, well, I guess the website of the Kirby Institute would be also where people can find what I do. And they've got links to the different papers that I've written. So that's one way. But I was saying, oh, yeah. And then for the HIV community, I think there's a lot of things that have been done with the community organization with who I work. So NAPWA, the National Association for People Living with HIV Australia, Positive Life, and Positive Life exists in Victoria, New South Wales, and Queensland. And I hope I'm not forgetting someone, otherwise people can be cranky at me. But they've got amazing resources. So if you HIV positive and you're listening to that, and again, the long COVID story, look at the APRISE website, APRISE, APPRISE. .org.au, so you can find some information on that. And as the our progress, there's going to be more information in the future.
Absolutely fantastic. I think great resources that I think branch out to a lot of other areas, and I'm assuming they're all going to be developing and you know, putting out updated knowledge as it comes about. So you know, it's great to know that, you know, we're, you know, medicine and research like yours is starting to look, I think, more of that nuanced space where we're going to look further than just the chronic. I think when it's chronic, sadly, it's not reversible for many, many situations. And I think all of us are very invested in whether it's early intervention or just early, what am I able to go out and do? And one of the blessings of living in a first world country is that we have not everyone, but a lot of Australians have the capacity to think about their well-being earlier in life, and that's a blessing that we can take advantage of. And you know, your type of research I think speaks to that, and I'd like to think that as countries develop and technology reaches other parts of the world, they can also take advantage of the work that we've already done, you know, when those luxuries reach them. So I see this as being incredibly important, and you know, thank you immensely, and you know, appreciate your time and your work and your contributions.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Just want to add one or two websites. So I mentioned Dementia Australia. Mm-hmm. For people who, you know, I've got a question about that. There's a lot of amazing resources on that. Okay. The Alzheimer's Association is great. And then my collaborator here at UNSW called Professor Karen Anstey, who's the head of the Aging Future Institute at the UNSW, with who I collaborate. And so we're trying to do a dementia prevention program together with Professor Brewer St. Vincent's. It's early days, but bringing all that research in, trying to detect things early and manage early. So that's all other resources there.
No, community. Lovely, lovely. Happy if you would like to, you can also send through any of those links, and we can attach to our podcast notes for anyone that's interested. They can click on those. But I think you know, they're our primary national bodies and the like, so it won't be too difficult to find. Lucette, really thank you again. Really do appreciate your time, and I wish you all the best in continuing research and continuing to also put those very difficult links and links together. And I hope that our culture, our community, can continue to change and evolve. I think it's quite positive in nature that this conversation is even taking place. Obviously, there's people like yourself who are interested, and lots of others out there who are living with these conditions who have a voice as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.